stock market and the boom in day trading was already a big story to watch earlier this year. Stocks only go up, went the mantra of Barstool founder Dave Portnoy. Meme Lord and Tesla CEO Elon Musk became the richest guy in the world, and Robinhood's free stock trading app made it one of the hottest private tech companies. Internet culture, technology, low interest rates, the pandemic, all were at the center of it. Things were already feeling a little bubbly. But as you certainly heard, things got even weirder this week. GameStop was the most traded stock in the world as an army of day traders on Reddit and Discord pushed the market capitalization of the struggling video game retailer past $10 billion. This was the memification of the stock market at its craziest, and tech companies were in the middle of it. Thursday, the stock fell after Robinhood and other brokerages halted trading. Is this the end of capitalism as we know it? The end of the internet? Probably not, but there are plenty of interesting things to sift through. This is Corey Weinberg. I'm a reporter for The Information. On this episode of The 411, I chat with Information columnist and former Facebook executive Sam Lessin about whether Robinhood made the right move, as well as alternative reality communities, and what's up with all these internet billionaires going all populist. But the stock market isn't the only form of entertainment available to the masses. There's also sports. And in our second segment, Tom Dotan and Jessica Tunkel join me to talk about their story this week on ESPN's tough financial spot. The sports TV powerhouse has been under pressure from cord cutting. So what's the game plan it's going to draw up? But first, my conversation with Sam Lessin. So we're bringing Sam Lessin onto the show today. Sam Lessin, of course, is an Information columnist. Thanks so much for coming on, Sam.
I'm always psyched to talk to you, Corey.
So you are a really interesting thinker, prognosticator, builder. You're also a builder, Sam, on sort of the internet. And we wanted to have you weigh in a little bit on the news of the week, which is GameStop. And I was hoping you could sort of kick us off, tell us a little bit about where we go from here, primarily. Like, as we speak right now, Robinhood has halted GameStop trading, as well as some of the other platforms. Where do you see this going? What's your bigger picture thought on all this?
Yeah, I mean, I've been following this pretty closely for a while, at least as long as anyone possibly could have been, and like kind of it's been fascinating to watch. I mean, I don't think anything here so far is that surprising. It's literally just a reprise of what we've been watching happening in politics played out in a new venue with all the same talking points. I mean, I think the reality is when I look at what's happening with GameStop, you know, I think part of the reason it's happening so quickly is everyone's just taking their playbooks that they were already developing for Trump and a lot of the politics stuff and, you know, just replacing politics with the stock market and like replaying the exact same debates. So it's kind of funny. I mean, I think like, you know, in some ways, I find this extremely unsurprising, although still fascinating to watch.
For sure. I mean, you sort of have a bit of a Trumpian sort of aspect here where you have people who just sort of want to watch the world burn in some respect, who are bidding up the price of GameStop stock and in hopes of squeezing out the shorts.
For what it's worth, I think it's too cynical to say these people want to watch the world burn. I think one of the lessons people have learned from politics in the last bunch of years, as well as honestly from crypto, where I think a lot of these people have, you know, cut their teeth and kind of these realizations are made, is that, you know, reality is whatever enough people decide reality is, right? And so I think, you know, if you think about I think there's like a really important insight, right? Which is we've historically lived in a media landscape in a world which is reasonably top down in a lot of ways, and you kind of had a consensus reality and there was a value to believing in and playing that consensus reality game. And like people have realized that if you splinter a group off that's big enough and they all really deeply commit to believing something alternative or different, that they can impact and kind of chip away at that meta narrative, right? And I think the reality is that the snowball effect of these things when you get them rolling or whatever, it's certainly played out in politics, but I think it can play out even faster as it has been in this case of GameStop.
Right. Well, I think one thing that sort of all opens up, and I think something that people are really struggling with right now, is like, who is ultimately accountable for what happens in these sorts of moments where there's tons of unpredictability, there's money on the line, and there doesn't seem to be a like responsible actor in all this. Like there isn't that gatekeeper, I guess. Would you, if you were like head of product at Robinhood, what would you have done?
I don't know. I mean, I think the reality is like it's a no-win situation for them. I think what they did is perfectly reasonable, you know, because I think, but like, look, they're going to get sued no matter what they do. And they're going to destroy a lot of trust no matter what they do. Robinhood is not a platform. It's a private company, right? You know, they might have sold their narrative as power to the people and kind of give everyone access. And I think that's what creates the issue for them, is like once you build that narrative and attract millions of people to it, you're kind of stuck with it.
I think I'm curious to see whether companies almost try to make themselves more memeified in a way, and in a way that Elon Musk has sort of mastered the art of that. And sort of you've seen Tesla become one of the most valuable companies in the world amid the pandemic, and amid this sort of stock market surge. Like, I don't know. I wonder if there's going to be any actual effort on the part of companies to try to like get in on this action rather than sort of being in an accidental way.
I think that what companies will do, if I were a company, like what I would do is think really hard about where my meme army is going to come from that's pro me. I don't know if that means like getting people like my customers invested in me, or like how do I get effectively the mob on my side for sure. I mean, again, Tesla's a really interesting one, right? Because like, the stock is not rationally priced in any I mean, the stock is priced as an Elon Musk trading card. And like, that is like this, it's not that dissimilar than GME, right? It's basically like a bunch of people, you know, deciding to choose an alternative reality. And as long as enough agree, then the price can be supported. And look, as an investor, you're like, that's an interesting strategy to think about and how to think about it. You know, as someone who's like, wants the world to be rational and like everyone to agree on how to look things, it's very counter to the dominant narrative of what people think should be happening, right? So, I mean, people like to say, I mean, I've heard smart people say, well, at least the Tesla one's productive because they make good products that are important, or like there's a future narrative to it. I understand that. I'm not sure I agree. I just think, again, like all these things, there's going to be, are you priced based on future earnings and growth? Are you priced based on dividends, which is an old narrative that no one really believes anymore, right? Are you priced based on just like what enough people are going to believe in the future, right? Which is, I think, in some ways the scariest one, because there is no traditional value. There's just belief. But again, like I'm a huge Bitcoin fan, and like Bitcoin is fundamentally a, you know, not completely dissimilar narrative. It tries to be more universal, but you know.
Right. It's just based on purely human imagination, I think is how Matt would.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, if you force me, I mean, the difference is I think Bitcoin is based on, is unabashed about the fact that it's purely about imagination and strives to be global. And I think there is value in that. But there are plenty of ways to knock that argument and say, yeah, fine, GME, you know, it actually is a company and was supposed to be priced differently or whatever. And sure, it's kind of hard to believe that being like a global reserve currency, as some people have been joking, but it's not like night and day, I'll be the first to admit.
Right. All right. I guess another political element I'm interested in here, as someone who's kind of interested in the political ideology of Silicon Valley, but last week, early this week, we had sort of increased talk of someone like Chamath Palihapitiya, you know, maybe running for governor. And he has sort of made his brand off of sort of a pseudo populist, savvy investor rhetoric.
Is it pseudo populist? I think it's straight populist.
It might. Oh, yeah, you're right. It's straight populist. And, you know, I think it's strange to kind of watch, I think, sort of the populist streak of Silicon Valley sort of almost ramp up in this moment. And even, you know, with people sort of really criticizing the Robinhood sort of decision in that vein.
I mean, look, I think the real thing that always frustrates me is I would say, like, I think that everyone increasingly understands the game. The question is, how do you play it, like, with honor to some degree? I think the problem with a lot of these populists is, like, they're very savvy to the game. Like, they understand what's happening, but they choose to, like, use it for personal advantage or manipulation rather than, I think, in my mind, having a much more honest conversation about the challenges we face as a society and that the internet poses and how to, you know, how to basically thread the needle. So, I mean, my basic view is I have very little respect for populists on this because, like, to me, like, their strategies are obvious and they're willing to play character bit parts. My sense is someone like a Chamath is smarter about the big picture challenges and balances than he lets on. But once you have the ring of power, you know how to use it, right? The question is just, are you going to have an honest discussion, which is, man, like, I don't know how we have a really hard global problem dealing with a world of complete memory, instant free communication to anyone on Earth. We have big challenges to figure out how to think about and deal with questions like encryption, et cetera. Like, who's going to have an honest conversation about these conflicts and how we get along versus who's just going to use them for their own advantage? So I think that's the real divide in Silicon Valley is, like, if you really understand technology and you spent a long time around it, you get the game, right? The question is, again, are you using it for personal leverage or are you actually trying to solve problems?
Right. Sam, thanks so much for coming on. And this is a really fascinating subject that we're not going to solve today.
Not yet.
All right, now let's bring in information reporters Tom Dotan and Jessica Tunkel to talk about the worldwide leader in sports, ESPN, which is kind of going through a bit of an identity crisis, a business crisis. At least it doesn't seem to have quite the shine that you might expect it would inside of Disney, its parent company, which has obviously been doing quite well of late off the streaming boom. Tom and Jessica, thanks for coming on to talk about it.
Hey, Corey.
Thanks for having us.
So walk me through a little bit of the high-level new stuff in this story. What's the state of its business prospects right now?
Well, in one sense, they're going through, like you said, a rough patch. ESPN, like every cable company out there, is seeing like a major attrition of cable subscribers. Just there are fewer people that are paying for cable. And, you know, with sports specifically in ESPN, there are just fewer people watching sports. There's been this decline in ratings for almost every single sport over the last couple of years. And then the pandemic has been kind of an accelerant to that. It's been pretty incredible to watch sports like the NBA, which had been so incredibly popular and be able to withstand a lot of the rating declines, just really not recover during the pandemic. Even the NFL, you know, which is not down as much, but still is lower in the ratings than it has been. So there's this sort of 1-2 punch of cord cutting plus sports that have hit ESPN acutely. And, you know, as Tunkel and I reported on for, you know, a couple of weeks, this has taken a huge toll on this business that had been the crown jewel inside, I mean, not just Disney, but like of the cable industry. And they're kind of at this point now where they're looking to sell off some things that are not core to their future. And their future, of course, is streaming.
Right. So what does this broad review of ESPN assets look like? How extreme are we talking here? What are some realistic possibilities, Jessica?
I mean, I think that they're looking at everything through the lens of what helps our streaming strategy. And by them, I mean ESPN, but I also mean Disney, which obviously has gone, you know, completely into all focused. It doesn't matter who gets hurt in the way. We are focused on our streaming business and growing it. So I think they're starting with very obvious examples of businesses that weren't making any money and don't really add anything to their streaming strategy. So we reported that the X Games is for sale, which is, you know, the extreme winter sports events. It wasn't making a lot of money. It was not doing particularly well. I mean, you could also argue that maybe you could redo it and it would be great for ESPN Plus because that's the kind of sports you would want for it. But I just don't think it was making enough money for them to care about. And so that's going to go off the table. I think they are continuing to review their international assets. I mean, ESPN has not been, you know, very active and very competitive on international as much as others have. And so I don't think that anything is imminent, but I wouldn't be surprised if down the line they do sell some of their international networks.
It's fascinating. I actually didn't even realize ESPN owned the X Games. It feels very like 90s to me, the X Games.
No, totally. And I mean, it's actually kind of ironic because the reason they launched the X Games in the 90s to be able to connect more to younger viewers.
Yeah. But it points to like a really interesting question because you guys point this out in the piece, which is, okay, the bread and butter the moneymaker for this business is the fact that they carry a lot of live games, a lot of live professional sports games, NFL, MLB, etc. And they keep having to pay up more for those rights. Like, and but they can't not have those games. Like, they don't seem to have like all that much leverage anymore. Like, are they just sort of having to spend like crazy to kind of keep the rights essentially to what they already are paying for in the four professional sports?
Yeah, totally. And it's kind of this amazing paradox that's been playing out. I mean, it's, you know, our editor Martin Pierce would probably call it like a slow motion train wreck of the sports industry, and the fact that even as the ratings go down, because sporting events are the few things that can still guarantee some kind of an impressive audience, the rights keep going up and the networks keep paying more for it, and there's more competition for it, which pushes it up even more, but there are fewer people paying for cable. I mean, it's just this amazing confluence of opposing directions that has made the business squeeze, you know, in both directions.
Right, right. Well, why hasn't ESPN Plus been the kind of smash hit success like Disney Plus has been for its parent company?
I think, you know, just going back to the sports rights discussion, the thing that's getting more and more expensive, the thing that people always watch is football, and they can't put football, and that's going to continue to get more expensive. And frankly, I think that's why ESPN is cutting costs and everything, because they need to save money to be sure they get the rights when they come up, I believe this year or next year. But ESPN Plus is all the sports that they have the rights to put on there. They can't put anything on there, right? Because the cable companies and the leagues would violate all those agreements. So the sports that they're putting on there are smaller, less popular sports, as well as, you know, they're creating their own shows and things like that. But none of it is a huge driver to get people to watch it.
Yeah, and I do want to quickly say there that it's not Disney Plus, because there really nothing is Disney Plus other than really Netflix. It's done okay. It has 11.5 million subscribers. They've overachieved their projections initially. So I wouldn't necessarily count it out as a dud within the kind of crown jewels of Disney's streaming services. It is the third place, but I actually think that, you know, for certain types of sports fans, they have the UFC on there. That was a coup. You know, they bought the exclusive rights there, and that got them a surge of new subscribers. So within the, you know, the kind of hyper popular niche sports, they have a place for it, which again is sort of interesting that the X Games couldn't have been that, and just is more an indication that that whole, I mean, I would argue that a whole generation of Gen X people has just not really turned out to be what we thought it could be.
And last thing, I mean, we haven't touched specifically on the fact that this is also a company that laid off 300 people last year, 6% of its workforce. What is it like working at this place right now? You know, this sports world titan, you know, of Bristol, Connecticut.
It's tough, man. I mean, you know, I think on a number of fronts, they've just been battered. There's the cable stuff, which we've talked about a lot, you know, but over the summer, Black Lives Matter did a real number on ESPN, which, I mean, this is a whole other topic, but, you know, they've tried to be as apolitical as they can be over the last few years. But then as Black Lives Matter really became very intertwined into the sports world, that caused a lot of unrest at the company, and, you know, a lot of the Black employees feeling that they needed to kind of express the point of view and the discrimination that they experienced there. And that was really tough on them. And then, like you're saying, it's just the ego of it all. You know, they were kind of ensconced in this palace campus in Bristol, where they were the kings of the world for so long, and having to see layoffs, having to see major talent, you know, people like Bill Simmons or Colin Cowherd or Dan Lebatard, you know, a pretty well-known sports guy who left at the end of last year. It's less and less the coolest place to work. And I think that was a big draw for a lot of people. You know, I think a lot of people there are diehard sports fans, and ESPN is still the biggest name in the sports world, but it's, you know, it's just not as, it's not as cool to tell your parents and your friends you work there as you used to. And that's kind of why we do anything.
Yeah. And we haven't even talked yet about the fact that they have Alex Rodriguez broadcasting Sunday night games. I mean, like, what the hell? Like, bring that guy in?
No, it's a disappointment on so many fronts.
All right, Tom and Jessica, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
That's our show this week. Thanks so much for listening. This episode was produced, as always, by Ariella Markowitz. Thanks so much for Sam and Tom and Jessica for joining me on the episode. Talk to you all next week.